At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
The Texas oil boom of the early 20th century created fortunes for a few enterprising individuals who would go on to become powerful figures in the business world. Some of those men also exercised their influence in the political realm. And since we're talking about Texas, the wealthiest oil men all knew Lyndon Johnson. In this episode, we'll explore the careers and relationships of H.L. Hunt, D.H. Byrd, Sid Richardson, and Clint Murchison. Did these Texas oil tycoons have a reason to want to get rid of President Kennedy? And more importantly, if they did want JFK out of office, did they take any actions to accomplish that objective?
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. In the early 1960s, half of the oil reserves in the United States were in Texas. The six companies that controlled 80% of that oil benefited from a special provision in the tax code known as the Oil Depletion Allowance. Enacted in 1916, the depletion allowance allowed oil companies to retain a percentage of their oil income tax-free. In 1963, that number was 27.5%. The purpose of the depletion allowance was to provide an incentive for wealthy entrepreneurs to invest in oil exploration. During the 1960 presidential election, John F. Kennedy wrote a letter to Gerald Mann, the director of the Kennedy-Johnson campaign in Texas. In that letter, Kennedy said that he favored a thorough study into the resource requirements of the United States before making a decision on the future of the oil depletion allowance. But by 1963, President Kennedy apparently had obtained the information that he was looking for and began to advocate for a reduction of the oil depletion allowance. This was noted in a New York Times article on January 25, 1963. As part of a comprehensive tax bill, Kennedy wanted to reduce the amount of the oil depletion allowance for producers who were making more than $5 million a year. It's not clear whether he sought to remove the entire allowance or just reduce it. This policy that threatened to do away with the oil depletion allowance was viewed by the Texas oil industry as a direct attack. That's because the allowance resulted in an additional $280 million a year in profits being paid to Texas millionaires instead of the government. Over these last few episodes, we've spent some time covering Lyndon Johnson's lucrative interactions with the private sector during his ascent to power. A central hub of those connections was the Sweet 8F Group, an informal network of politically connected wealthy Texas businessmen who met on a somewhat recurring basis in Herman Brown's suite at the Lamar Hotel, Suite 8F. Herman Brown was the co-founder of Brown and Root, one of Lyndon Johnson's earliest backers who saw growth due to government contracts that Johnson helped Brown and Root secure. For about 30 years, Brown lived in Austin, but would commute to Houston and stay overnight a few nights each week in the same hotel room. There's not much known about the informal network of the Suite 8F group, aside from the fact that the most powerful men in Texas were involved in it. It was very private, and the group would often work together to back certain political candidates. For example, Suite 8F backed the careers of Franklin D. Roosevelt, Sam Rayburn, and Lyndon Johnson. Reported members of the clique included Johnson and Rayburn, as well as the Brown brothers, James Elkins, founder of international law firm Vinson and Elkins, William Hobby, who Hobby Airport is named after, Ed Clark, one of Lyndon Johnson's attorneys, H.L. Hunt, Clint Murchison, John Connolly, and Sid Richardson. Standing alone, the Suite 8F group's informal membership list doesn't prove anything. Still, it does show that all of these people were in the same circles and many times were pursuing the same goals, like making sure the oil depletion allowance stayed in place. Let's get to the big-time Texas oil men that were mentioned at the top of the show. First, we turn to Haroldson Lafayette Hunt, who went by the initials HL. Hunt hit it big in the 1930s in the East Texas oil fields and then became the primary oil supplier for the Allies during World War II. By the mid-1950s, H.L. Hunt was one of the wealthiest men in the world. When he died, he was worth the equivalent of about $15 billion in today's money. In 1956, attorney John Currington became H.L. Hunt's personal assistant. His job was to do whatever Mr. Hunt asked without asking any questions. In 2018, Currington shared his experiences working for Hunt in a book called H.L. Hunt, Motive and Opportunity. According to a New York Times article, we know that Currington did work directly for H.L. Hunt. That same article says that Currington was convicted for embezzling funds from the company. Currington blamed this embezzlement charge on an intra-family feud that happened after H.L. Hunt died. Either way, John Currington is the real deal when it comes to H.L. Hunt. In November of 1958, Hunt launched the Lifeline radio show to provide a platform for his right-wing, extreme anti-communist politics. Lifeline was a 15-minute daily program that broadcast on over 500 radio stations across the country with about 5 million listeners. Currington says that General Edwin Walker would regularly come by and wait in Currington's office until Hunt was available to talk. General Walker and H.L. Hunt moved in the same political circles, and Hunt and Currington visited General Walker's home both before and after April 10, 1963, the day that someone fired a shot at General Walker's house. It makes sense that Hunt and Walker would be political allies. Still, it was news to me that these men were close enough that H.L. Hunt went to General Walker's home multiple times. In July of 1960, shortly before the Democratic presidential convention, H.L. Hunt convinced his famous preacher friend to help Lyndon Johnson by attacking Senator John Kennedy from the pulpit. At the urging of Hunt, Dr. W.A. Criswell, one of the most famous preachers in the world, who happened to be the head of the First Baptist Church in Dallas, where Hunt was a member, denouncing Catholicism and John F. Kennedy. H.L. Hunt then had this political sermon printed and mailed to 200,000 pastors across the country. In 1964, the World's Fair was set to be held in New York City, which was a big deal. Hunt had the contract to be the fair's amusement vendor. According to Currington, in mid-October of 1963, Robert Moses, the organizer of the World's Fair, asked Hunt to visit him in New York. During the meeting, which Currington attended, Moses terminated the contract because he said Hunt only wanted the contract to promote his Lifeline radio show. After the meeting, Hunt called Lyndon Johnson for help, but Vice President Johnson said that he couldn't do anything because there was a higher authority that made the decision. Hunt took this to mean that President Kennedy ordered Hunt's contract to be terminated. On the airplane back to Dallas, Hunt told Currington, quote, "John, I've had about a bellyful of those Kennedy boys. They both need to go." Okay, so H.L. Hunt did not care for John F. Kennedy, but does Currington allege any actions by Hunt that could possibly show actual involvement in the assassination? Maybe. Sometime in 1962, Currington says that Hunt asked him to contact Dallas mob boss Joe Civello to ask him which Chicago bank his mafia friends in the Windy City would recommend. Hunt knew Civello well and would regularly meet with him at his liquor store near Love Field or at the Admiral's Club at Love Field. Civello told Currington to set the account up at the Continental Illinois Bank. H.L. Hunt then sent a letter to the bank with a $250,000 check enclosed. Currington says that there's no reason for Hunt to have an account in Chicago because he already had other accounts in Dallas, New York, and Switzerland. Currington doesn't know what happened to the money after the account was set up. On the day of the assassination, Currington was the one who told Hunt about the shots being fired minutes after the motorcade passed the Hunt office building. When he relayed this information to Mr. Hunt, Currington said that Hunt, quote, paid no attention to it at all. Currington also makes claims in his book that, if true, would connect H.L. Hunt to Marina Oswald and to the murder of Lee Harvey Oswald. At 6:30 a.m. on Saturday, the day after the assassination, Hunt called Currington to come into work and asked him to lock the steel door between the two connecting buildings on the seventh floor. Currington says that this is the only time he ever saw this door locked. Hunt then asked Currington to make sure that no employees were in the building and to stand in the lobby downstairs to tell any incoming employees to go home. When Hunt arrived in the lobby at 8:30 that morning, he told Currington that there would be a woman coming into the building soon and that Currington was not to look at her or even acknowledge her presence. A few minutes later, Marina Oswald walked in the front door. She was there for about 20 minutes and then left. She arrived and departed in a black car with U.S. government license plates. Why would Hunt want to meet with Marina Oswald? Out of curiosity? Would he really be able to just summon her in a government vehicle? We have no idea what this alleged meeting is about. Currington, who is certain that it was Marina Oswald, says that he doesn't know either. Hunt never spoke of it again, and Currington would have been fired if he would have asked. I don't know about you, but when I need to get into that Curtis LeMay, sitting there watching the autopsy vibe, I look for a cigar that I can rely on. And that's why I love Thompson Cigar. They've been around since 1915, so they know a thing or two about cigars. Whether it's a quick 5-pack for the weekend or joining one of their value clubs, Thompson makes it easy to save while enjoying top-notch cigars. It's like having your own personal humidor with deals that you can't pass up. Visit www.thompsoncigar.com/JFK or use code JFK at checkout for 20% off of your order of $75 or more. Discover why Thompson has been America's humidor since 1915 and join the thousands of satisfied customers who trust Thompson for quality, value, and exceptional service. Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? I'm talking about Mood.com's incredible line of functional gummies. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code JFK. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. They found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to target nearly every mood and health concern you can think of. Best of all, not only is every product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, you can get 20% off of your first order with code JFK. So head on over to Mood.com and find the functional gummy that matches the mood you're looking for. 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code JFK. Perhaps the biggest allegation that Currington makes is that around 5:30 on the Saturday afternoon after the assassination, Hunt asked him to go to the police station to assess the security situation around Oswald. Currington says he did as he was asked, and he was eventually able to see Oswald being escorted by Will Fritz in handcuffs with no additional security around him. Currington relayed this information to Hunt, who then told him to call Joe Civello, the same Dallas crime boss Hunt relied on for the best bank to use in Chicago. Hunt wanted Civello to come to his home, and according to Currington, Civello visited Hunt's mansion at 6 a.m. on Sunday morning, just hours before Jack Ruby would kill Lee Harvey Oswald. Currington says that Hunt did not know Jack Ruby, but when Ruby's car was searched, he had two copies of transcripts of H.L. Hunt's radio show, Lifeline. While Ruby was in jail, Hunt asked Currington to keep up with all of his activities and visitors. Currington claims that he received regular reports about Ruby and passed that information on to H.L. Hunt. Finally, Currington provides an interesting tidbit on the mysterious Mr. Hunt letter allegedly written by Lee Harvey Oswald. He says that after the assassination, the letter showed up in their interoffice mail. When it did, they reported it to the FBI. Currington said that he did not know if it was a fake or if the letter was authentic. One more thing on H.L. Hunt. According to the church committee files, on the day before the assassination, Thursday, November 21st, both Jack Ruby and mafioso Jim Braden visited the Hunt oil offices. Paul Rothermel, the director of security for Hunt Oil, said that Braden was accompanied by three other men in the office. Braden told his parole officer that he was visiting Lamar Hunt about oil business. The Warren Commission concluded that Jack Ruby was at the office because he drove a woman friend of his there to help her get employment. An interesting conclusion, given that Lamar Hunt's name was found in Jack Ruby's notebook. Let's move on to the next Texas oil millionaire we'll be covering, David Harold Byrd. When Byrd first began in the oil business, he started as a geological scout, initially without much success. The first 56 wells that he drilled produced no oil, garnering D.H. Byrd the nickname of Dry Hole Byrd. Eventually, when he was 28 years old, Byrd's persistence paid off and he drilled two productive wells and reinvested the money to drill for more wells. Those other wells would make D.H. Byrd a millionaire and allow him to diversify his holdings. In the 1930s, when he began to attain his wealth, Byrd became interested in aviation. This led to him co-founding the Civil Air Patrol in 1941, shortly after Japan attacked the U.S. Navy at Pearl Harbor. The purpose of the CAP was to use civilian aircraft to supplement military aircraft. This was before the Air Force was officially chartered. Yes, this is the same Civil Air Patrol that David Ferry and Lee Harvey Oswald were in. Byrd was the commander of the Texas and Louisiana Division of the CAP from 1948 to 1953, which overlaps with the time David Ferry was in the CAP. But there's no evidence that Byrd had any direct contact with David Ferry or Lee Harvey Oswald. Byrd's love of flying wasn't just a hobby. He wanted to get involved in the aircraft business. In the 1950s, Byrd co-founded Temco Aircraft. As we previously covered, Mack Wallace's new job after he was convicted of murder was working for D.H. Byrd's Temco. Byrd also got a job at Temco for Raymond Femer, the father of Lyndon Johnson's personal secretary, Marie Femer. Byrd was a financial backer of Lyndon Johnson and had a close personal relationship with him. There are numerous thank you notes and kind letters back and forth from Johnson to Byrd over the years. However, Johnson did not invite Byrd to the 1964 presidential inauguration, which Byrd did not appreciate, as noted in a letter he wrote to Johnson on January 19, 1964. In 1939, D.H. Byrd purchased the Texas Schoolbook Depository Building at an auction. Only about a year before President Kennedy's assassination, the Texas Schoolbook Depository Company became the main tenant of the building. A few weeks after the assassination, Byrd had the window frame from which Lee Harvey Oswald was said to have fired a shot removed. Byrd's son said that the reason the frame was taken out was to keep it preserved because vandals were destroying it. Critics began to wonder about Byrd's true intentions when he hung the window like a trophy in his banquet room. In November of 1963, before the assassination, D.H. Byrd, the founder of Temco, and James Ling, the founder of Ling Electronics, used a shell company to buy 132,000 shares of LTV stock. For context, D.H. Byrd previously owned only about 35,000 shares. The purchases happened at a time when the LTV stock price was sliding because of threatened antitrust litigation. By 1967, the 132,000 shares that Byrd and Ling bought in November of 1963 for $16 each were worth $169 each. The Vietnam War was quite good to the shareholders of LTV. Just 2 months after President Kennedy was killed, allegedly from the window of Byrd's building, Byrd's company, LTV, was awarded a contract to build a jet bomber from Johnson's 1965 budget before it was even approved by Congress. The fact that such a massive volume of stock was purchased at that moment in time seems to point to potential foreknowledge by Byrd and Ling. Either that, or they just got super lucky. On the day of the assassination, Byrd was reportedly on an African safari. However, researchers Russ Baker and Rob Smith have analyzed Byrd's African safari story with some surprising results. First, the photos taken from the safari that are labeled D.H. Byrd do not actually show D.H. Byrd. It's someone else. Second, Byrd was known to personally take photos with any big game that he killed. But on this safari, there's a photo of an elephant that was said to be shot by D.H. Byrd with two hunting guides standing next to the elephant, not D.H. Byrd. Also, Byrd said that he went on the trip with a Dr. Davidson, but according to tour guides, there was no one named Davidson there. Not to mention the temperature in Mozambique, which is where Byrd was said to have traveled, reached extreme heights in November each year. I don't know for sure if D.H. Byrd made up the safari story. If he did, that obviously begs the question, why? Another wealthy Texas oil tycoon was Sid Richardson. While Richardson died in 1959, before President Kennedy was elected to office, he was still an important player. Richardson befriended Elliot Roosevelt, the son of President Franklin Roosevelt, in 1933. A few years later, President Roosevelt spent a weekend with Richardson and his business partner, Clint Murchison, fishing off of Matagorda Island, Texas. Richardson was also an early and major financial backer of General Dwight Eisenhower's successful bids for the White House. Sid Richardson is perhaps most notable for co-owning the Del Charro Hotel in La Jolla, California, with Clint Murchison. As we discussed when we covered J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI director vacationed at Del Charro every year. While everyone viewed Hoover as an extremely powerful man, Richardson once told Hoover in front of others at a party, quote, "Edgar, get your ass over here and get me some more chili," according to author Brian Burrow. Richardson's top aide was Lyndon Johnson acolyte John Connolly, who spent 9 years working for Richardson. Johnson is the one who introduced Connolly to Richardson, which led to Connolly being Richardson's attorney, lobbyist, and the co-executor of Richardson's estate. Richardson also knew George de Morenschild from the oil industry, according to an Army intelligence report. Another major Texas oil player was Clint Murchison. In addition to owning the Del Charro Hotel with Sid Richardson and sharing all of the same connections with J. Edgar Hoover and the Mafia, Murchison, like H.L. Hunt, was one of the earliest developers of the East Texas oil field. He later diversified his wealth into life insurance, banks, railroads, manufacturing, and hospitality businesses, working with his son, Clint Jr. Murchison was a political ally of Lyndon Johnson since the late 1930s and began frequently corresponding with Johnson in 1945. He was staunchly anti-communist in his political views. Murchison, as well as Richardson, were both supporters of Senator Joseph McCarthy until McCarthy eventually fell out of favor with them. There are two other very important allegations related to the Murchison family and the Kennedy assassination. First, according to attorney Daniel Sheehan, Clint Murchison Jr. owned a ranch in Oaxaca, Mexico. That ranch was used to train what Sheehan calls the S-Force, a group of mercenaries and Cuban exiles that was training to kill Fidel Castro using triangular fire. There is, of course, much more to this story. The real question is, why does Danny Sheehan believe this? And the answer is that Sheehan was a junior associate lawyer working for F. Lee Bailey when Bailey represented Santo Traficante in the early 1970s. According to Sheehan, Traficante himself told Sheehan's investigator the entire plot, including the part about the Murchison Ranch in Oaxaca. The second important allegation is that there was a party at the Murchison home the night before the assassination where key figures, including LBJ, discussed the planned murder of the president. We'll unpack that disputed story in the next episode. Next time on Solving JFK, we wrap up our study of Lyndon Johnson by analyzing Johnson's time as vice president, whether Johnson would have been invited to stay on the 1964 ticket if Kennedy lived, the alleged Murchison party, and the big question, was Lyndon Johnson involved in the assassination of President Kennedy? If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.